Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey everyone, it's Billy Morrison and Ozzy Osbourne here. Our new show, The Madhouse Chronicles, is dropping this April. Join us as we watch and react to the maddest internet clips. What do we discuss, Ozzy?
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, all that kind of shit.
Drugs, rock and roll, aliens, and all that kinds of shit. Visit osbournemediahouse.com for early access. What do you say? Do you think it's the wildest show on the internet?
Oh.
You're in the madhouse now.
This is Steve Woodruff, author of The Point, How to Win with Clarity-Fueled Communications, and you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which has been named by Forbes and LinkedIn, amongst others, as one of the top marketing podcasts. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since I get to read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message that you're a listener, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. My name again is Douglas Burdett. All right, let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome back Steve Woodruff to talk about his book, The Point, How to Win with Clarity-Fueled Communications, published by Morgan James. Steve Woodruff is known as the King of Clarity. He is a consultant and author who has helped solo consultants to Fortune 100 pharmaceutical companies with their communications strategy and messaging. Over more than four decades, Steve has taught, sold, presented, preached, marketed, blogged, authored, collaborated, coached, and networked. And at the core of every one of those activities is figuring out how to communicate clearly and effectively. That is how the idea of finding a single practical recipe, the Clarity Fuel Formula, evolved. He released his first book, Clarity Wins, in 2018, which was featured on episode 220 of the Marketing Book Podcast, with a focus on helping professionals with their branding and referral network. And, interesting fact, he and his wife are the proud parents of five sons, one of whom served in the United States Marine Corps.
I am Gunnery Sergeant Hartman, your senior drill instructor.
Steve, congratulations on The Point, and welcome back to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome back, friend. I knew this day would come.
Douglas, always a pleasure to talk to you.
So, Steve Woodruff, at what point in your marriage did you and your wife decide to niche down to only having sons?
I think that was actually predetermined because I was one of four boys, and my dad was one of three boys, and his dad was one of two boys. So it was kind of like, you know, roll the dice. Oh, look at that, boys again.
So it runs in the family.
It runs in the family, except two of my sons now and their wives are expecting, and we have two granddaughters on the way. So I am going to have to learn how to braid hair and understand what the color pink is.
Excellent. It's great. It really doesn't get any better. I have a daughter, and both my brothers have three kids, and the oldest one had three sons, the second one had two sons, and finally, they had a girl. And when my wife and I were going to have our first child, it was a son. She was little, this niece of mine, and they said, oh, their Uncle Douglas and Aunt Pam are going to have a son. And she said, why would anyone want to have a son? And as a result, she grew up to be pretty tough with all these boys around. So she's going to do just fine. And she's already kind of in charge of everything. So I just know that you have saved a ton on wedding costs. So
yes, yes.
Now, this came up in my recent conversation with the tequila influencer, Jay Bear, when he mentioned your book. And he wrote the introduction to your book that you have a son, another son, different son, who is a bourbon influencer.
Where's my bourbon?
Tell us about that.
Well, my oldest son, Nate, he's always had a sort of a creative and entrepreneurial streak. And some years ago, he and I both started to get interested in the bourbon, whiskey, rye world. And he really ran with it. And he started to take beautiful pictures of whiskey and bourbon and in the wild on hikes and in beautiful settings. And he started a whole movement on Instagram. He's got about 80,000 followers on his account, Whiskey with a View. But he also got to serve as a brand ambassador and a consultant with a number of brands. And now he's in the process of standing up his own brand, which is going to have a sort of a Wild West theme. And he's been backed by some venture capitalists. And so it's really exciting days. He's got a tremendous palate and a tremendous eye for photography. So it's been just great seeing him develop.
That's great. And is there a brand name yet?
Not yet revealed.
Okay.
I know it, but I'm not telling.
Okay. You tell me, but then you'd have to kill me and all the people listening. So
and
great.
That would be the end of these episodes. And we
yes.
can't do that.
Well, and it probably would reflect poorly on that upcoming brand of bourbon. And I'm really going to watch that closely. So I should also mention, you were also on Authors in Quarantine Getting Cocktails when the lockdown happened and all these past guests like yourself were already drinking and they didn't have anywhere to go. And they said, yeah, Douglas, I'll talk to you again. So I appreciate you doing that. My family appreciates the fact that you would speak to me for an hour so that they didn't have to listen to me. So one question I have to ask the King of Clarity, speaking of all this alcohol, being an expert on communication clarity and seeing examples every day of how poorly that's done, has that sometimes driven you to drink, Steve Woodruff?
Well, I think I could use that excuse. I've seen some stuff that has so boggled my mind that, you know, two or three good shots of whiskey needed to forget about it. So, yeah, I'll buy that excuse.
Okay. And also, reading a book like yours, it's like reading a book on customer experience, and then I see how poorly something is done, or I'll see how poorly something is communicated. And that's just when I listen to my own interviews. So, changing the subject, you grew up in Berlin, and you don't have a German accent at all.
Was ist los mit dir, mein Schatz? Geht es immer nur bergab?
All right. So, have to correct you right off the bat. In the town in Connecticut I grew up, they pronounce it Berlin. And you will be corrected instantly if you call it Berlin. So it is Berlin, Connecticut.
Okay. And not Berlin, New Jersey. So, all right. Okay. So thank you for clearing that up. And apologies to the listeners in Germany. So let's see. March of 2019, episode 220. We talked about Clarity Wins. This will be episode 456. So about every 4.5 years, I expect you to come back. Every 236 episodes, to be exact. So just so you know, Steve Woodruff, I've penciled in episode 692 for you, April 14th, 2028. So everybody mark their calendars.
What you don't know is I've been taking these episode numbers and playing the lottery with them. So I'm expecting at some point I'm going to make $1 billion just by appearing on your podcast.
Well, you will. And it'll be because you've joined the Marketing Book Podcast 3-Timers Club. Now, what has happened that a lot of people don't know is that every member of the Marketing Book Podcast 3-Timers Club, and there have been others, like Jay Bear is now a member of the 4-Timers Club and so forth. Mark Schaefer is the 9-Timers Club. There's about 20 of them now that have gone to 3 episodes or more. Every single one of them has won the lottery.
Oh,
so
okay.
Not a coincidence, but you might want to go ahead and start planning for that with a third book. So this book is endorsed by some of the authors whom I've had the honor of interviewing, including Josh Burnoff. I recently interviewed him about his latest book, Build a Better Business Book. And also, the book is endorsed by Mark Schaefer, who is the king of the Marketing Book Podcast.
I am your king.
And Tom Martin, author of The Invisible Sale. So, very exciting to see that. And you're the king of clarity. You live in Tennessee. Mark Schaefer, king of the Marketing Book Podcast, also in Tennessee. It's a hotbed of royalty in the United States, in the great state of Tennessee. So, Steve, as I was reading your book, and as I often do, I make jokes on each page and tell myself jokes because I find the books entertaining, but I also like to joke around. This bit from Steve Martin kept running through my head.
Well, anyway, I guess you can tell that I'm into language, and language is kind of my thing, being a comedian. And if you don't have a command of the language, nothing to be embarrassed about, but because this is my profession. And let's face it, some people have a way with words, other people... not have way, I guess.
All right.
Okay. Enough comedy jokes.
All right, let's get into the book. So before I read a couple excerpts, I want to describe the book. It's organized in four parts. First part is about the challenges to clarity. Second part is about the four clarity fuel formula rules, which we're going to talk about. And then part three is a number of clarity fuel formula tools. And the fourth part is applying clarity best practices in a variety of settings. And we can't get to all the tools and settings. But I want to read a few excerpts from the beginning of the book, beginning with page XXI of the introduction, and then jump to a couple other pages very quickly. I wrote this book so you can win at the most important competition of all, getting your point across and accomplishing your purpose in every sphere of life. As you begin the journey, here's my promise. By skillfully and consistently applying the simple tactics of the Clarity Fuel formula, you will become an increasingly effective communicator. And here's my premise. The most direct route to successful communications is to package your messages in what I call brain-friendly formats, a skill anyone can learn and apply. And then jumping over to page two, it's trench warfare out there in our noisy, boisterous world. Every day, your audience is barraged by figurative dump trucks spilling out piles of words at their front doors. Your daily challenge and mine is to figure out how to break through and rise above the noise. Clarity will help you win this battle, and I'm going to hand you the best weapons I've found. And then jumping all the way over to page 43, here's my working definition of clarity: focused ideas expressed in brain-friendly words. In this book, I'll outline dozens of ways to craft the most effective words you can use to light up your listeners' brains. But beneath each clearly expressed message is focus, a specific idea, purpose, goal, or intent. Focused clarity of thought fuels clarity of expression. And then jumping over to the next page, every single human being on this planet can benefit from applying the practical methods of gaining and communicating with clarity. No exceptions. CEOs and salespeople, parents and pastors, IT professionals and marketers, authors and social media influencers, every company, every job title, every function at any age and in any language, clarity of ideas and words apply everywhere. And then jumping to the next page, so starting right now, I am bestowing upon you a new title, Communication Designer. Actually, you already have this title. I'm just making you aware of it. My goal with this book is to make sure you are highly effective at designing your communications by practicing brevity, simplicity, and clarity in your word use, whatever your role in business or in life. And finally, to the next page, in a world where artificial intelligence is making deep inroads in the production of words, it is even more imperative that we humans become more skillful, more creative, and more able to connect with fellow humans through clear communications craftsmanship. You can do this. You can rise above the noise. You can turn the lights on in the minds of others. In this book, you will learn the straightforward rules of clear communication, and you will acquire the practical tools to achieve it. So, Steve Woodruff, why is it so difficult to be heard and understood? What are the hurdles that get in our way?
Well, the major hurdle is what I call everybody's competition. And everybody's competition is all the noise out there. There are so many screens, so many streams of information, so many channels, so many people, so many billboards. There's this overwhelming amount of input into the people's, our audience's minds. And somehow we have to get our message through all of that. And you mentioned in some of those passages, I use the word brain friendly a lot. This whole approach about clear communications is based on brain science. And so one of the fascinating facts is that the human brain is processing 11 million bits of information per second from all five senses. This is something your brain and mine and every listener, we're doing this. We don't even know we're doing it. We're not even conscious of it. We've got 11 million bits coming at us in our brain. And our brain has to filter that down and focus. And focus on what is most important right now. And that's 60 bits. If I'm talking to a human person, an individual, and paying attention, that's 60 bits. And that's all I can focus on at any moment. So our competition, our challenge is we've got to win the 60-bit battle against 11 million bits of competition. We'd better be really, really interesting, good, and clear to do that.
Yes, and I love the quote from the Irish playwright George Bernard Shaw. The single biggest problem in communication is the illusion that it has taken place. Tell us the story about the Russian oligarch's chateau in France.
This is one of my favorite stories.
This made my jaw drop.
It's hysterically funny and horrifying
yes.
at the same time. And I originally started using this story when I was doing workshops with my corporate clients on project management. And here's how to fail at project management. So this guy, Russian oligarch, had a bunch of money. And he decided he wanted to own a real fancy place in somewhere in France. And so he finds this chateau that's been kind of abandoned a little bit, you know, in Bordeaux, decides to buy it. And then he contracts with a Polish construction group to go there and do some cleanup work, knock down a shed that's in the back, you know, get rid of some detritus. And so this Russian guy contracts with this Polish group to go into France and clean this thing up. And obviously, he wasn't practicing clear communications because they knocked the entire chateau down. Somebody was not clear on the scope of work, did not make a real clear summary of the work. And even barring the language barriers between, you know, French and Polish and Russian, someone really did not communicate with clarity. And so the guy ended up with this big pile of rubble for his chateau.
Well, you have another story that's even worse. Talk about what happened with the Mars Climate Orbiter, which was a big mix-up between, I guess, NASA and Lockheed Martin.
Yeah, it's horrifying. So, you know, most of the time, it's just a sort of a kind of a fun little banter between the metric system and the imperial system. And so the U.S. is, you know, uses its old system and everybody else in the world has gone metric. So when the planning was being done for this the Mars orbiter's entry into Mars atmosphere, one set of engineers was using numbers, but using the metric system. The other set was using the imperial system. And nobody caught the mismatch. And so this multi-million dollar craft was about to do what it was supposed to do, go into orbit, and instead it just burned up in the Martian atmosphere because the math was wrong.
Our tax dollars at work.
Yep.
I wasn't aware of that, and I've since I saw it in another book since I read that, but it's just troubling. So now, not all these mix-ups have to be that big, but they can be pretty big. Now, you talked about the noise. You frame a lot of this as the gaps, the noise, and the fog. But I thought it was interesting that you write that businesses always strategize around their biggest competition when trying to gain customer engagement. Newsflash, the primary competitor is not another company or brand. It's noise. Say more about that, because I think that there's this unfortunate misperception that companies have that people are interested in their products and services and what they have to say about them, and they don't understand that it's a drop in the ocean.
Yeah, if you're a bookstore somewhere in a small town like Franklin, Tennessee, where I am, and you might think, well, my competition is Amazon, or my competition is Barnes & Noble, or my competition is this other bookstore in Nashville. Those really aren't your competition. Your competition is people don't know who you are, where you are, why you exist, and you haven't broken through. And so for any of us, from a big company to a small company to a solo, what we're up against is the fact that people's minds are in a million places other than us. And somehow we've got to rise above that and be more compelling, more vivid than all of that other static. And that's a huge challenge. It's an enduring, evergreen challenge that we all face no matter what business we're in. And even if it's not business, you know, a teacher, my wife is a teacher. She's up against the noise, the screens, the distractions with her students every single day. And this is what we're all up against.
It's interesting. A few years ago, I interviewed the Marketoonist, Tom Fishburne, about his book, Your Ad Ignored Here. And it was about the first 15 years of his being a cartoonist. And it's just, it was an interesting book for a variety of reasons, because a cartooning is extremely difficult form. And they're brilliant. And it was sort of like seeing the last 15 years, like a review of the last 15 years of marketing, the things that he would focus on. And I remember asking him, you know, do you ever worry about running out of material? And he said something interesting. He said, I don't think so, because I'll never run out of material because companies still think they have a captive audience.
Mm-hmm.
So yep. One thing I do want to ask, though, if this is one of those things where I want people to take it away, explain what you mean when you write that the people that win in life are focus earners, focus earners.
Mm-hmm. That's that 60-bit battle. So there's no way I can sell or market or advertise or do a podcast or any of these other mechanisms of communication, or even get somebody to read an email, unless I can grab that 60 bits. And so what that means is that the brain science behind it, and this is one of the major things in the book, is we have to front load our messages with the what's in it for me. For our audience, something relevant. That's the key to gaining focus, is I've got to speak in the relevant terms, the interesting terms, the things that are new and important to my audience. If I just blab on and on and on, I might have important things to say, but if I don't quickly get to relevance, the 11 million bits will overwhelm what I'm doing, and I won't have that focus. So if I don't win the focus battle, I lose everything. I don't have a chance to explain or to document or to go into any details. I've already lost that person's brain. And that's why getting to the point is one of the four rules of the Clarity Fuel formula. You've got to get quickly to the point to win that focus.
It's interesting. Over the years, I will be talking to a group and I will explain that every one of their customers listens to the same radio station. And they say, really? Which one?
W-I-F-M.
What's in it for me?
Yep.
So I want to quote from page 15. You write, beware, listeners, this may upset you. Nobody cares about you, your company, or your offering. Ouch! But there's also good news. They might start to care if you succeed in creating a message that speaks to their wants.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Steve Woodruff, explain the reticular activating system. RAS, which I think of as like a nightclub bouncer for what our brain decides to pay attention to.
That's it. That's a good analogy, actually. So it's a nightclub bouncer. It's the filter. It is the administrator at the front desk that guards the doctor's office. The RAS is this wonderful neurobiological filter, and it is the thing that is taking those 11 million bits and deciding, and this is all unconscious, it just happens. It's deciding what we're going to focus on, and it's deciding that based on immediate personal relevance. So if I got a string of four emails in my inbox all at once, and one of them said, you know, learn how to speak Russian in 48 hours. And one of them said, potted plants for sale. And one of them said, you know, I don't know, travel to Micronesia. And then another one said, your son has just been injured in an accident. Guess which one I'm going to click on? And so the RAS is there, and it's partly a survival mechanism.
Yeah.
It is there to make sure we're paying attention to what matters. And when you understand that that is the front door into people's attention, then you craft your communications to be RAS friendly. Mm-hmm. And you quoted earlier from the book where I said we are all communication designers. And that's one of the key points in this book. Every one of us is a communication designer. We're either bad or good. And the book is here to help you become real good at it. And one of those things is to learn how to be RAS friendly.
So what does brain hostile communication design look like? In other words, so we talk about being RAS friendly, which we'll talk more about, but what are some of the biggest offenders when you have brain hostile communication?
The biggest is another acronym that almost everybody knows, which is TMI, too much information. Mm-hmm. So it's a large amount of unstructured information. That's what shuts the brain down. If I see a mass of text or a confusing diagram or a 6 million word email, that is overwhelming. And the human brain does not want any more overwhelm. I put it this way, don't give me the haystack, tell me where the needle is. So brain hostile communication is dumping a haystack on people and saying, well, you sort it out, you figure out what's good. No, that's not communication design. Mm-hmm. That's just dumping things. And that in business and in just about every other endeavor, that is the most common brain hostile thing, is just dumping stuff. And similar, but not exactly the same as TMI, is vagueness. Mm. Just leaving things vague, undefined, full of jargon, where you can't figure out what's being said. And that shuts the brain down too.
So when you see all this lack of clear communication throughout the day, I'm guessing that you just look upon all that as an opportunity. These could all become prospective clients for you. It's like my friend, the sales trainer, he would get cold calls all day. And they were so bad, he was actually able to convert them into customers on,
correct,
on how to do sales training. So, Steve Woodruff, let's talk about rules.
The first rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club. Second rule of Fight Club is you do not talk about Fight Club.
Now, Fight Club had 8 rules, but Steve Woodruff only has 4 clarity fuel formula rules, because Steve Woodruff is all about clarity. So the first rule of Clarity Club, and I'm just calling it that for this interview, okay? The first rule of Clarity Club is you shall have a point, or as Steve Martin said to John Candy in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles,
here's a good idea. Have a point. It makes it so much more interesting for the listener.
So Steve, what is the point?
Yeah. You know, the funny thing is, I actually begin most of my discussions with the second rule, which is get to the point, because people intuitively understand that and they feel the pain of having been on the wrong side of people not getting to the point. And so I usually start with that because it's immediately relevant. But then I back up and say, the first rule, though, is you actually have to have a point. You can't get to the point if you don't have a point. And
okay, that seems like something people might not completely understand.
Well, the thing is that the reason why people meander and communicate poorly is often they don't actually know where they're going. Mm-hmm. They don't have a clear purpose. They don't have a clear destination. They don't have a real clear way of saying it. And so they're just blabbing. And to be on the receiving end of that is extremely frustrating because we want to know where we're going. We want to know what's the purpose. Why am I listening? Why does this matter? It's all about the relevance.
Yeah.
So when it comes to having a point, I encourage people this way. I say, if you can't tell what the actual purpose, destination, result is in one sentence, if you can't put it down yourself and say, here's what I'm trying to do, there's no way you can get to the point with somebody else because you don't even know where you're going.
Right.
Have the words around it.
So the second rule of Clarity Club, as you mentioned, is you shall get to the point. And I loved it because you started touching this. You wrote, keeping your audience in suspense. Okay, listen, folks, this is not a good thing. Keeping your audience in suspense while you wander in the wilderness is not being a good information tour guide.
AIDA, attention, interest, decision, action.
So talk about the design sequence you use, which is ARIA.
Right. So a very simple way of making your information RAS friendly is, first thing, ARIA, I've got to get your attention, the A, the first A. So in any way I'm going to design this, I have to make sure I'm front loading in a way that gets your attention, secures those 60 bits. Right on top of that, I've got to move to R, to relevance. So why should you listen? Now that I've got your attention, why does this matter?
And that would go back to like the four messages you got, and one of them has to do with your child.
Correct. Yeah. I've got to get there quickly. I don't have the RAS is making split second decisions. I don't have 10 minutes to get to the point. I have seconds, sometimes milliseconds. You've probably seen the statistics. People jump off of websites in just milliseconds if they don't see what's going on right away on the homepage, if they don't see something that's interesting, they don't have a relevant message. And that's why people that load up their websites with a whole bunch of jargon, nonsense, and too many graphics, they lose people because they're not getting right to relevance. So that's AR. If you've secured attention and shown relevance, now you've bought the right to share your information. That's the I. Now I've got you locked in. Here's what I'm really talking about. I can expand on it. And then the final A in ARIA is, what's the call to action? Okay, so if you've got me, if you shared all this, now what? What are we going to do with it? ARIA is a very simple formula that is used, whether anybody's ever used it or not, as far as I know, I'm the one that came up with it. But this is the same formula that 30-second ads use. They grab your attention. They immediately show you the relevance. They share that information. And then say, in the case of a drug ad, here's the call to action. Go to your doctor and ask about blah, blah. And if you can't pull all that together in 30 seconds, you're going to have a hard time securing people's engagement. So we can use that ARIA framework for composing an email or setting up the agenda of a meeting or doing a sales pitch or really just about anything.
Attention, relevance, information, action. And on page 67, I chuckled when you wrote that effective communication is not a game of 20 questions.
That's correct.
The third rule of clarity is you shall get the point across. Explain what you mean when you write that most people settle for message sent without realizing that the goal is actually message received.
Yeah, it's, and this goes back to that quote, assuming that communication has taken place.
Yeah.
So the fact that I have projected words out, either vocally or written or whatever, doesn't mean anybody's has actually received it or understood it. And even if somebody has processed those words, they may not share the same meaning or intention. We may not actually be aligned in what the understanding is. So what we have to do as good communication designers is to define, explain, simplify, and illustrate. That's, and I call this turning the light on. This is how we turn the light on in the other person's mind so that they actually do get the point I intend them to get. I'm actually getting it across into their understanding. And many times people just throw stuff out there and assume everybody's heard them and know what they're saying. And you find out later, you have 10 people in a meeting and they walk out with 10 different things. That we didn't get the message across.
Right. And also reminds me of hearing somebody say, well, I sent the memo.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I sent them an email and yeah. Well,
I sent a 10-page PDF,
yeah,
single-spaced.
Right, with a small font size so that I could fit it all in there. Let's jump to the fourth rule of Clarity Club. You shall get on the same page.
Always be closing.
You write that in sales, people learn about ABC, always be closing. The best practice in all forms of communications, though, is ABS. And we're not talking about anti-lock braking systems. Steve Woodruff, explain ABS. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is you've got to always be solidifying what you've said. You've got to, the goal here is particularly business, but not just business. We want to see people move in a certain direction. We want some kind of action, some kind of agreement, some kind of alignment. We're actually looking for an outcome. So the way that we design our communication is we're trying to lead to everybody being on the same page. Go right back to what we talked about before, the meeting. If we had a meeting with 10 people for 45 minutes, we're going to need to create a summary at the end, a written summary, simplified communication that says, here's what we discussed, here's what we agreed on, here's what's going to happen, here are the action items. Then we have hope of being on the same page. If we just throw words out and then let it float and assume that everybody knows what's going on, that's when you end up with a chateau raised to the ground.
Right. Yeah, you quoted Dale Carnegie. He said 90% of all management problems are caused by miscommunication. And, you know, related to the meeting, you write, this is on page 79, you said, during my many years of working with corporate clients on their collaborative projects, one of the most common and painful experiences was the struggle to get everyone to agree on anything. And then you write, really agree.
Mm-hmm.
Go further down there. Explain what you mean when you say really agree.
Well, everybody nods their heads in a meeting because that's the dynamic. You know, you don't want to be difficult. And so, yeah, we need to do this. We need to do that. Yeah, 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 yeah.
So is everybody clear on what they're going to do? Okay,
everybody
great.
Everybody clear? You got it? Yeah, okay, yeah. We're all agreed we're going to do this, and it'll be all ready by, you know, the 3rd of September. Well, no. We have to assume that miscommunication is rampant, and that's one of the ways I open the book. We have to just assume the reality that miscommunication happens a lot, and the only way to make sure that we are going to get on the same page is to create the page. And I saw this in project management. So I worked as a vendor for companies, and we would create projects and work with our clients on projects. And often projects would go sideways when somebody didn't make it clear exactly what the scope is, exactly what the timeline is, what does this word mean, who's responsible for what. And so many, many times, nobody was creating the page, which can either be simple or detailed. And usually you want both. You want a simple up top and then detailed underneath it. That's how you prevent misunderstandings. That's how you prevent accidents and misfires, is you've got to actually assume if people can get it wrong, they'll get it wrong. So up front, let's get it straight.
Yeah, I think there was there a quote from Napoleon here at one point where about basically if something can be misunderstood, it will be.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. And that's why in the run-up to recording this podcast with you, You have sent several emails with very, very clear summaries of exactly what to do, what not to do, what you expect, and that's the right way to do it. Because your experience has been that people will blow off the details, they won't read one of the emails, they'll kind of do some dumb thing. And the best podcast hosts that I have talked to over-communicate in a way that makes sure that we get it right.
Yes, and it's a great example where I think over the years I realized I wasn't communicating something clearly enough, or that what I was communicating wasn't understood.
Mm-hmm.
In our remaining time, let's talk about a few of the tools and best practices. And you'll just touch on a few, but you write that the human brain is hardwired for stories and that storytelling is a crucial component for effective sales, leadership, public speaking, long-form writing, professional networking, you name it. Every form of communication is enhanced by using stories. How do people struggle with using stories in your experience?
Mostly by not using them enough. So the fact is that stories nail stuff down in our minds. They illustrate. So people will forget a lot of what we say specifically on this podcast, but they probably won't forget the Russian oligarch. Why? Because it's a story. And it's a story about bad project management. Now, we could have talked about 14 principles of good project management, and nobody would remember any of them. But they're going to remember, those guys didn't get the point across.
Or the Mars orbiter, yeah.
Or the Mars orbiter.
Yeah.
So stories are just wonderful ways of nailing down, illustrating, turning the light on. And the 8 tools that I detail in here, which all start with S, statements, snippets, specific stories, stakes, symbol, and by stakes, I mean, you know, what's at stake, what's at risk, what's the benefit, symbols, side-by-sides, and summaries. These are the common things that every writer has always known. I didn't make any of those up. I mean, we just know these things. But these are the things that turn the light on quickly, that engage the mind. If I say, you know, there's a bunch of traffic today on I-65. Okay, whatever. But if I say, starting at exit 30, there is a 2.7-mile backup, which is going to take 33 minutes to clear, that's going to turn the light on in my brain because it's specific.
Mm-hmm.
And if I say something along the lines of, you know, podcasters are great. Douglas Burdett's fine. He's got, you know, the market. But if I say Douglas Burdett is the Mercedes of podcasters, I've used a symbolic language to hook onto an existing memory hook and say a bunch of things, but all summed up in an analogy.
Mm-hmm.
That's great communication.
Yes. So you've touched on a few of these S's. Let me ask you about just one other, and that is about raising the stakes.
Mm-hmm.
And you write that marketers and salespeople know that one of the biggest challenges is creating a sense of urgency, and every single salesperson listening to this will know what I'm talking about. And as I was reading the book, this particular part, I was reminded of a movie from, 30 or more years ago called Crazy People with Dudley Moore, where he was an ad man. And he started to have a nervous breakdown, and he started making these commercials where he would just tell the God's honest truth in all the advertising. And I mean, he really did go crazy. And so he would create all these ads where they were just being brutally honest with people. And it worked. The problem was all the ads got produced and they started airing, or they were running in magazines. And the problem was they started working really well. And let me play one of them here about Metamucil. This is where the couple of the executives are in the office, and one of them is yelling at the other one about the ad.
Metamucil, it helps you go to the toilet. If you don't use it, you'll get cancer and die.
And in the movie, what happened is they then show all these pharmacies, like down in Florida, where people were bribing the pharmacist to get the last bottle of Metamucil. And then they did a great job of raising the stakes. There's another one here for Volvos. Listen to this.
Buy Volvos. They're boxy, but they're good. We know they're not sexy. This is not a smart time to be sexy anyway, with so many new diseases around. Be safe instead of sexy. Volvo. Boxy, but good.
So, you write that inertia is the enemy of change. How can people better raise the stakes other than trying to run ads like those two?
Well, there's a way to exaggerate things, and then that, you know, it's the boy that cried wolf. So if I say to somebody, buy my book or you will, you know, let's go Metamucil, or you will die of cancer within 6 months, okay? Mm-hmm. So that sounds high risk, high stakes, you know, scary.
Yeah, I remember years ago National Lampoon magazine ran an ad that showed a little puppy, and they had a revolver next to the puppy.
Buy this issue or we will kill this dog. It's yes. One of my favorite visuals ever, because the side eye that the dog is giving, yes. I just absolutely love that ad. Mm-hmm. But you see, when you have something that's true about the stakes, and so I use the stakes argument when I talk about getting to the point and the 60-bit focus challenge. The fact is, you can have a fantastic company, a fantastic product, you can have a huge market need, but the stakes, the moment of truth is, can you secure somebody's attention? If you can't, you lose. That's high stakes. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I highlight that in the book, is this isn't just a bunch of, you know, nice advice you could just leave to the side and it won't matter. It actually matters to your success as a leader, as a marketer, as a teacher, as a pastor, as a human being. The stakes are enormously high. And so what we have to do is let people know, you know, here's the potential benefit, and here's the potential loss, here's the potential risk. And that's what secures the relevance part, is, oh, this isn't just a bunch of neutral slush. This matters.
Just a few questions about some of the best practices. We're getting to the very end of the book here. An example. And these are, let me just say, it's like email presentations, teaching and training, leadership, collaboration, purpose statements, branding, personal branding, and career direction, social media, and networking. Just to touch on a couple of these because they're very, very practical. Let's talk about email. According to Gallup, 70% of employees want shorter digital communications at work. So explain how composing punchy, effective emails is your best training for putting clarity into practice.
So email is always my lowest hanging fruit. And despite the fact that the death of email has been prophesied forever, we're all still using it. And so it's a mission critical way of communicating, but it's also extremely frustrating because we have a very noisy inbox battle and emails are flooding in all the time and people are going through a survival process of skim, skip, delete. And what's that based on? It's based on the subject line and the first sentence. It's based on glance, the visual real estate of what comes first. And we're right back to the RAS again.
Mm-hmm.
Are you getting to the point with your subject line and your first sentence? So that's the easiest place and the most consistent place for anybody to put clarity practice principles in practice, is front load your email with whatever that person needs to know right away. Douglas, I need your input by 12 noon this Friday. In the subject line, mm-hmm. not five paragraphs down. Or, you know, we need this form to fulfill your health insurance requirements by next week. So I encourage my clients to take the call to action or a deadline or something that's highly specific and put it right at the front so that you will grab that focus in a very busy inbox. But what you're doing is the very practice that any podcaster, any marketer, any advertiser, any speaker has to do. It's the same principle. Front load with relevance.
Yes, and I'd like to suggest another book that goes even further into this, which is by Ann Janzer, and the book is 33 Ways Not to Screw Up Your Business Emails. It was on the show a couple of years ago. It was a special Christmas episode. And I'll include a link to it at this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. But I think that short book should be given to every new employee. It'll have a dramatic effect on the organization. Let's jump to presentations. I had to chuckle when you said your audience is silently begging for a reason to tune in and focus. What are some of the biggest clarity killers in presentations?
Well, the first one is obvious. Let me know right away why this matters. So tell me where we're going and why this matters.
Here's a good idea. Have a point.
Exactly. But the second one, and oh, this just drives me insane, is slide design. And there are a couple huge problems with slide design that people, when they're presenting, use. And the biggest one is right back to the haystack, to too much information. If you put too many words up on the screen and too many bullet points and too many, you're distracting me. I can't pay attention to what you're saying. I've only got 60 bits. I'm either going to pay attention to you or I'm going to be trying to sort through all these words. And especially if it's in small fonts or if you've got multiple confusing graphics or pictures, you are defeating the purpose by being brain hostile in your presentation. You're making me confused. Do not overwhelm the audience. So when it comes to making a public presentation, the idea is to make the slide very simple, clear, a fewest words possible, maybe one graphic, so that someone looks at it, says, oh, that illustrates the point you're making, and then they're paying back attention to you. If you're making me fight to figure stuff out, we both lose.
Right, and reading an eye chart.
Yeah, reading an eye chart is not the way to do it.
Unless you're at the eye doctor.
Oh, my goodness. I've got people that should know better. I mean, professional trainers. Putting up these slides, and it just makes me want to bang my head against the desk because we're not there to read. If you want me to read, send me a white paper. But the slides for a presentation are not there for an in-depth details. Give me the details in some other format. But when you're presenting, you're performing. Yeah. And the slides are there to be an illustration and an enhancement, not a distraction.
You mentioned in that section about Guy Kawasaki's 10-20-30 rule. Tell the listeners about that.
Yeah, so you want to have as few slides as possible, and you want to spend as little time as possible, and you want to have as big a font as possible so that you're not, again, overwhelming people. And I see the font problem all the time. You know, when people try to crowd too much on the screen and they shrink the font, and then someone all the way to the middle or the back is squinting. As soon as you've got squinting, you've lost it. You've lost that audience member. And so the whole goal is to just make every single slide as simple and clear and intuitive as you can. And to just make it so that people can look at that for a second or two and go, yep, got it.
Mm-hmm. So 10 slides, no more than 20 minutes speaking, and mm-hmm. no font smaller than 30.
That's kind of a rough guideline. I mean, I like it, but there are times when you're going to do a 30-minute presentation, you're going to do a 60-minute, you're going to do a 5-minute. So, you know, but what he's saying is don't overdo it. Make it simple and clear and easy to follow. And so whether you go 20 minutes or 30 minutes, whether you use, you know, 10, 20, or 30, whatever, just make it intuitive.
Yes. And years ago, we had a client that needed help with a presentation. It was a new client. And so we said, how about if we do it the 10, 20, 30 way? And he was like, oh, I don't know, I guess. I mean, he wasn't as familiar with making these presentations. Anyway, we set it up for him, doing the 10, 20, 30. And he said, oh my God, that works so well.
Yeah.
Don't do it any different in the future. That's exactly what from now on, I'm doing the 10, 20, 30 approach. So it was great. I've got to ask about a couple other things in this section that just you know, make me feel like I'm taking crazy pills. And one of them is positioning and purpose statements.
Hmm.
Oh, you write that they provide the North Star for any company, large or small, to express exactly why they exist. They are the foundation stones of a brand. They are powerful for shaping culture and for informing day-to-day decisions. Clear statements help create aligned teams and even keep individuals on track. How do these positioning and purpose statements go wildly off the tracks and become horribly generic and vague?
Yeah.
Well, what's been your experience as to why this happens?
Well, there's one part of it that's a little bit unavoidable, which is if you have a big company that has multiple divisions and lots of different parts and pieces, then you have to have some very high-level purpose statements, very high-level mission and vision statements. Now, they should be clear. They should at least say, look, this is exactly why we're here and who we serve and what we're doing. They shouldn't be, you know, we exist to make good results for all of our stakeholders across the enterprise. I mean, that's just total BS. And that's how a lot of these are. It's just generic jargon.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, let me interject here. You write one for Edward Jones, the financial firm. At Edward Jones, our purpose is to partner for positive impact, to improve the lives of our clients and colleagues, and together better our communities and society. I mean, the same thing could be used for a hemorrhoid cream.
Exactly. You could take that statement and put it at the top of the building for just about any company, because it's just totally, totally generic. And there's no way anybody working there can look at that and say, oh, that's going to guide me into the specifics of my day-to-day work. It's not. It's just, you know, fluff. So we have to avoid fluff. But I believe, I'm convinced that the greatest opportunity for purpose statements isn't at the highest level of the organization. It's at the next couple levels down. So every division of a company, HR, research, sales, whatever, they actually have other purposes. They have other places of value in the organization that are subordinate to this highest level, but they're very specific to their group. And very few companies have clear purpose and value statements for their divisions and their teams. And that's where you can really get into the specifics of why this team exists in the company, the value it brings to the internal customers, the external customers, and how the people working there are going to contribute. And that, to me, is this vast, vast opportunity that companies have to sharpen the focus of their teams, is to say, we need mission and value statements and purpose statements for all the major groups, and even for all the jobs. You want to be clear on what the jobs and the roles are for, too.
Yes, they could just photocopy this chapter and send it around before the committee meets. And you've got a few pages here explaining specifically what to do. I, of course, had to laugh when on page 173, one of the points you say is, aim for something authentically aspirational. A purpose implies something helpful, something higher, something better. And then you go on to write, we exist to provide average mid-range products that no one cares about. Is not going to attract talent, investment, or customers. Don't think I didn't catch all these little jokes. Let's jump to branding. These are just the last couple things I wanted to ask about. You write, the goal of branding is to occupy mind space and heart trust, and you've succeeded in building an awesome brand when you are top of mind and tip of tongue. And then going over to page 180, you talk about, just to show folks how specific you get here, page 179, your brand should be summarized in 5 clear statements. Can you walk us through those quickly?
Yeah, and I introduced this in my prior book, Clarity Wins, mm-hmm. which really is all about branding. But many times, in consulting with companies, especially smaller companies and emerging companies, and said, okay, let's figure out your brand. If you can answer 5 questions, what exactly is it that you are providing for the marketplace? What's the product? What's the solution? What's the system? What's the thing? Then you've got to be very precise about for whom? Your specific target customer. And by this, I don't mean mid-sized businesses. I mean directors of HR in mid-sized manufacturing companies. Oh, okay. Now we know where we're aiming. Then the why. That customer is experiencing what pain, what loss, what need? What is it that's going to make them open their wallet? Then you've got to have a clear statement of your how. As a company, what's your superpower? What's your capability? What's the thing that makes you awesome that somebody should say, ooh, I need to go with these people?
And I think that companies have superpowers. They don't all realize it.
Correct. A lot of times they don't realize it. They take their superpowers for granted. And one of the things I love doing with both individual, and this all goes to personal branding too. It's actually the same set of questions, is, you know, helping people realize what their superpower is, because sometimes they don't think they're special. And I tell, look at what you're doing here. Look at how awesome this is. Do you realize how rare this is? No. Well, you know, this is your differentiator. And so that how is your differentiator. And then you want to define your where. You know, are you serving a local market? Are you serving just like a sector called sales training? Are you global? Are you online? Are you, you know, what's your where? When you can answer in single sentences, the what, the for whom, the why, the how, and the where, you've got the map for a strategy and a brand. Now you know where you're going. And sometimes people have these things sort of floating in their heads, but have not written them down. And when you write them down, now you can align the company around its purpose, its value, and its brand.
It's all on page 180, folks. Now, just two other quick things I want to ask you about. Related to that, and you touched on personal branding, let me ask you to talk about that. And also, again, this is quite a callback to your first book, Clarity Wins. You write on page 186, some people find the idea of personal branding to have an icky factor, as if it's hollow self-promotion. But that's not the point. And I want to quote from page 183. And this is something that you say is on someone's LinkedIn profile right now. Mm-hmm. And I quote, and I want people to think, have you ever seen anything like this? Leading cross-functional commercial operations teams in building sustainable capabilities across a large global matrix organization focused on co-creating, evolving, and implementing integrated and efficient multi-channel marketing excellence and sales excellence processes across regions and countries by innovating and continuously improving frameworks, tools, and platforms driven by business insights, engagement with region and affiliate partners, analyzing and benchmarking capabilities in and outside the industry, and delivering best-in-class capabilities that drive superior performance.
No, God! No, God! Please, no! No! No!
There's hardly ever been a better collection of horrendously ridiculous vague buzzwords than that one. It's just beautiful.
I salute you, sir, because I read about jargon in some of these books, and they grind my gears. But that one, oh boy, well done, well done.
So what
are some of the best and worst things people are doing as it relates to their personal brand? I know I mentioned there's a whole chapter on this and yet another book about it, but what are some of the really good things and just unforced errors that people have other than writing a LinkedIn profile like that one?
Yeah, the biggest unforced error is just this inertia of doing what everybody else is doing by using jargon, buzzwords, and generic terminology. So, you know, created results by doing blah, 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 and just describing their role, but not really talking about any specifics. We actually accomplished this. We did this. I was promoted for this reason to this role. Instead, it's just this kind of general flowing set of blah, blah. And there's no way to stand out and to differentiate if you sound just like everybody else on LinkedIn. So what I do with people on their personal brand is we start with the keywords and we do a keyword exercise and we go into, here's a whole set of keywords. Let's narrow down the three or four things that most of the time people say about you that you're really great at. And either solo or in teams, we work on the keywords. And once people get their keywords, Douglas, it's liberating. It's like, oh yeah, that's who I am. Because you can't read the label the jar you're in. We tend not to see our own strengths real well. Mm-hmm. And when somebody else reinforces it, it's awesome. Then we move to stories and say, okay, here's your key attributes. Now, tell us these stories, some success stories, and then your origin and evolution story, how you got to here and how you saw these strengths develop. And then you back it up with these stories, and it starts to make sense. The picture's starting to become clear. Oh, this is why you're in the role you're in. This is why you were promoted here. Then we move to statements. We say, okay, let's take all this and come up with clear single-sentence statements of your value. What you're all about, what your superpower is, who you serve, all that. It's branding. It's the same thing you do for a company. But the effect it has on people is remarkable, because once you know, you're self-aware, and you can say, here's the value I bring, it's a massive confidence builder. And it's one of the things I love doing the most, is words, brief, clear words, liberate people to be the best that they are.
Yes, and I think the people that read that, they probably want to say thank you for doing it that way. One other pro tip that I've seen as it relates to LinkedIn profiles is certainly for anyone in sales or business development, don't do your LinkedIn profile, don't write it for a recruiter, write it for a prospective customer.
Correct.
So, in other words, yep. Don't talk about how you're crushing your quota. Talk about the problems you've solved for similar kinds of companies or the people that are looking for what you sell. Last thing about the book I wanted to ask. You write about networking, a whole chapter on that. And you say, one of my favorite things to do is to help people become effective networkers. What kind of things do you find to be most effective for folks that has the biggest impact? What are some of it's almost like changing your golf grip and suddenly having a much better game.
There's a whole bunch of things that you can do with networking that are, you know, best practices, worst practices. But for me, the one thing that I encourage people to do, doesn't matter if you're an introvert, doesn't matter if you're shy, doesn't matter what your makeup is. And it's what I call story asking.
Yes.
You want to walk into a situation and you want to ask people their story. And I'll tell people, look, if you can ask this one question, you'll be a great networker. Here it is. How did you get from, say, your high school graduation and whatever you put in your yearbook to this role? And then just shut up and listen. And people will start telling their story. And then you can ask more questions. Well, who introduced you to that? Or why did you make this change? What made you decide to get out of sales and go into marketing? And the best networker is the one that's just doing an interview, just talking, just, you know, story asking. Mm-hmm. And that's what I do. I don't like schmoozing in large crowds. I don't like yelling, you know, in big, loud groups. I just hate it. But I will go off into a corner with one person and just go deep. And you'll create a friendship and a bond unlike any other if you just ask people their story.
Great advice. So, Steve Woodruff, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
My hope it would be, you know, foundationally, it's that people would embrace a role that they already possess, which is, I'm a communication designer. And you know, some communications aren't designed like talking with your neighbor across the fence and you're just yapping. Okay, so I'm worried about that. When it comes to purposeful communication, we are all designers and we can become good at it. These are skills that are developable. Is that a word?
It is now.
And that's why. Yeah, it is now.
Because, you know, Steve, some people have a way with words and other people not have way.
Yep.
You have way.
I have way. Mm-hmm. And so once you embrace that, once you embrace your identity, you are a communication designer, then it's really pretty much a simple choice. Okay, how do I become good at it then?
Yeah.
And then you're ready to roll.
Well, let's give the listener one thing to do. maybe like as soon as they finish this podcast, just to start down that path. You've touched on one earlier in the interview, but what's one thing a listener could do today to put in action one of the ideas from that we've talked about?
So one we talked about earlier was, and I always put it this way, your next email, your very next
yes.
email, front load that subject line and first sentence with what you're actually trying to do. So that's one thing. And that's really important. The other thing that when it comes to having a point, often people struggle. Well, what is my point? I mean, what does that mean? How do we do that? And I give a very little tactic, very simple tactic in the book on how do you figure out what your point is. And it's this: your audience, whether it's one people or many people, they're thinking, feeling, and acting a certain way right now. As a result of this communication, this talk, this email, this meeting, this book, whatever it is, how do I want people to think, feel, and act differently? Mm. What's the shift I'm looking for? When you can articulate the shift from point A to point B, that's the point. Now you've defined your point. I have a purpose and a reason for this communication. Very simple, but it applies to every form of communication. And if people will just take a moment before communicating and say, what am I really after here? How do I want that person to think differently, feel differently, act differently? Now you know where you're going.
Think, feel, act.
Yeah, it's setting the GPS. Say, look, there's my destination. Oh, okay.
Right. And I think what's helpful is you have an idea of maybe how they already think and feel and act.
Yeah.
So,
and it may not be precise, you know, like if I'm speaking to an audience of 100, okay, there's going to be people all over the lot, but I've got a pretty good idea that probably a lot of them don't know how to rise above the noise. Probably a lot of them feel frustrated with the fact that nobody's listening. And probably a lot of them are acting in a way that's dumping information. Generally speaking, that's happening. Mm-hmm. So I know where I want them to go.
Yes. But the problem is with anyone who's trying to communicate, I don't think they even start with how the recipient is thinking, feeling, and acting. So are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or looking forward to reading, Steve?
I want the autobiography of Douglas Burnett.
Oh.
I'm waiting. I'm waiting for that. And, you know, it hasn't come in the last 5 years. And, you know, I'm going to sit there and do a podcast with you if you'll just come out with that book.
Oh, wow. I'm not sure how interesting that would be, but I appreciate you saying that. Aside from that, any other books?
Actually, I'm kind of taking a break from serious books right now because I did a lot of serious business book reading in researching both of these books, and I'm kind of burnt out, honestly.
Any books? I mean, you may like fiction, you might like all kinds of things. Or any other books?
One thing I did, something I'm a very strategic think-through person, always. Everything has a plan. But sometimes I'll go to the library, and I'll just look at stuff. And I picked up a book last week, and it was I haven't read any short stories for like decades. I read full-length novels and thrillers and all this stuff. And like this book said, gee, this could be interesting. And I bring it home, and they're like 15-minute stories. It's like, holy cow, there's this whole genre I've been ignoring. That's really kind of nice. I can sit down and be done with it in 15 minutes. So who knows? Maybe I'll start getting into short stories.
Oh, well, there are a lot of great ones out there. I would recommend O. Henry or F. Scott Fitzgerald had some. And then there's another book I got years and years ago. It was The Stories of John Cheever, if you like that. And it was just it was fantastic. And I still have it. I look at it every once in a while. So anyway, that's great. Great advice. And everyone should be reading some fiction. So at marketingbookpodcast.com, we'll include links to everything linkable, including all the books that have been mentioned and your site and your LinkedIn profile and Twitter account. Now, a word to you, dear listener. I want to ask you a big favor, and I want to be really clear. Get it? please reach out in some way to Steve and congratulate him on this second book. Thank him for being a guest on the Marketing Book Podcast, putting up with the host's foolishness. Guests on the show have told me that they really enjoy hearing from Marketing Book Podcast listeners, particularly when you can contact the guest and tell them what you liked about the interview or if you have a question. Also, if you're listening on your smartphone, you subscribe to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app like Apple Podcasts, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on this episode's website link. The book is The Point, How to Win with Clarity-Fueled Communications. The author is Steve Woodruff. Steve, thank you very much for returning to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Douglas, I'm looking forward to the third episode when we finally hit the lottery.
Excellent. And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and found it helpful. If you are one of the hundreds of listeners who've left an iTunes review, please let me return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast bookmarks and laptop stickers. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world, and I'll drop it in the mail. And remember the words of the entrepreneur, author, and motivational speaker Jim Rohn, who said, "Formal education will make you a living. Self-education will make you a fortune."
Truth and travel?
Huh?
Forget France. The French can be annoying. Come to Greece, we're nicer.
So?
We're nicer?
The French pride themselves on being annoying. In Paris, they have contests. I mean, they're eligible for huge prizes.
Quaker Oats. Does this cereal taste great? Who knows? But at least the box is cute.
Right.
The box is cute?
The box is cute.
This is truly nuts. Jaguar, sleek and smart. For men who'd like hand jobs from beautiful women they hardly know.
That's what all of these ads really mean. Men buy these cars because of it. So why don't we just come out and say, hey, we know what you want. Here it is. This is for that.
This is getting scary.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.